Hi, this is writer-director Todd Haynes. I just directed the movie Carol, and you're listening to Film Wax Radio.
Buddy, this is Adam Chartoff, your host of Film Wax Radio, episode number 402. Today, the show is a whopper. I don't think I've ever used that term on the podcast before, but it is a whopper. It is, let's see, when I'm recording this anyway, it is April the 13th, and posting the show on April 14th, or overnight anyway, maybe it'll, somewhere between the 13th and the 14th. Anyway, it's going up, and the guests are Mike Lacey and Cole Smithy. Lacey and Smithy. It sounds like some British puppet show or something. Anyway, the show is described Gen X veteran film critic Cole Smithy and millennial filmmaker Mike Lacey copiously consume international culture and politics through the prism of a single film and a different craft beer every week. So every Friday the show posts. So actually after this show, I don't even know what the show's going to be today. But I did listen. I do listen generally. The last few shows, for instance, this past week was Life is Sweet, one of my favorites. Mike Lee, I remember seeing it at the Quad Cinema, Life is Sweet. That put Mike Lee on my radar. That's when I discovered Mike Lee. I fell in love with Life is Sweet, and I saw it first run at the Quad Cinema, whatever year that was. I was just walking by, and it looked good, and I said, I'm going inside. And then I went back and saw it again. I think I may have seen it even a third time in the movie theaters. I'm not positive, but I've seen it since. And then I went back and I saw High Hopes, all these Mike Lee. But then Mike Lee is not the guest, but we're going to work towards getting Mike Lee on the show. But having said that, you can go and listen to these two drunkards talk about Mike Lee and Life is Sweet. And then the one before that was Punch Drunk Love, which is a great film. I think if I look through their... Looks like they're getting close to 50 episodes. So anyway, that's the thing. It's called La Grande Bouffe, The Big Feast. And it's on iTunes and SoundCloud, and perhaps, I think it's on Stitcher. So you can go check it out. And these are guys, they were very entertaining. We had a great time. I've been on their podcast. Let's see. I was on an early episode. I think I was their first person they invited in to be a guest co-host. And I chose the conversation. It was quite a few months back in August. Anyway, so it's been... obviously about 8 or 9 months now and finally getting these guys on my podcast. So what we're going to do is you're going to hear this conversation. It's quite long. And on their show, we're drinking and we become just clouded with alcohol, if you will. I hope you can put up with it. I hope it's entertaining. If it's not, then what can I tell you? I apologize ahead of time. But these are two terrific guys. Happy to have had them on the show. And we'll have them back on at some point again. I'm not coming back at the end of the show. Why would I do that? Just to ask you to give me an iTunes review? You've already done that. You can go on right now and give a nice podcast review to La Grande Bouffe, Film Wax Radio. And also, if you're listening, go in and do a third one for this terrific podcast. It's called Lonely Hour. And it is by this lovely person named Julia Bainbridge, and it's about to have a second season. And I met Julia, and she's terrific, and we're going to have her on the next episode, actually, just briefly to talk about the second season of her show. I'm trying to connect more with other podcasters and be part of creating a community of podcasters, so that's my goal. So we're having Cole Smithy, and then next week we're going to have on Julia Bainbridge, and hopefully just continue in that pace. So here we go. For now, my conversation with Mike Lacey and Cole Smithy, and then listen to their show and then do the iTunes reviews, okay? For God's sake, how many times do I have to ask? Here out of a sense of solidarity or just a nod to your podcast, which is called The Grand Bouffe, The Big
we're
Feast.
Right,
yeah, that we've cracked open IPAs. I feel like if I don't do it, I'm transgressing. So I think I'm going to, even though it is my show,
yeah.
I normally drink wine, but I'm going to have an IPA with you guys because it is solidarity.
Thank you. We appreciate that.
I've never felt more accused of being an alcoholic than right now. It's just the idea we can't be on a show without beers.
Now, what I want to know is, if you drink every day, does that mean you're an alcoholic?
No.
Automatically? Because I find that I really like to have a couple of beers pretty much every night.
No.
Or a cocktail.
No, I mean, I don't think we're going to get into just defining alcoholism here, but I think you're doing fine, Cole.
Thanks, Mike.
That's an interesting conversation because I think when you're having a lot of stress, you rely on it more, but that doesn't necessarily mean you're an alcoholic. In other words, if your life were to get much less stressful because of whatever reasons, you might, in fact, not miss.
Can we talk about movie-holism? I feel like that may be more of a thing.
Cinemaholics?
Cinemaholicism.
Well, Leaving Las Vegas was the movie that ended Nicolas Cage. Nicolas Cage. That was the last time that he really created a character, and I think that he scared himself. I think he cut a little too close to the bone, and he said, I'm never going to go there again.
Mike Figgis directed that one, right?
Yes, he did. And whatever happened to Mike Figgis?
That's a good question.
I miss him. I thought he was going to do great things.
He did that one which had four. Remember the split screen?
Time code. Yeah, interesting movie. I like that.
Interesting
movie.
I mean, you know, it was far from perfect, but what a great experiment, which you have to applaud that came out far better than in the hands of somebody less capable, I think.
Well, I'm curious. I know that Adam, you recently interviewed Charles Burnett.
I posted that show just an hour ago.
And I find that incredibly fascinating. I wonder, you know...
Which part? That I posted it?
No, that you interviewed him.
Uh-huh.
Tell me more. Did you schedule it? Did you just do it live? Tell me everything about posting it.
Well, you know, actually, in terms of scheduling him, not the show, because I just finally just put it up because I had a hole in the schedule. I had a hard time. I interviewed him in September, so it's been 3 months. And
how old is he now? Killer of Sheep, of course.
I'm going to guess 60, early 60s.
Probably his most famous film.
Killer of Sheep. Well, let me put it this way: inside the world of cinema. Yeah, outside, I would say To Sleep with Anger.
Gotcha.
That's what I think. Glass Shield is also kind of popular, but I think To Sleep with Anger was a bigger film. But I think far more people saw that because it had Danny Glover and other famous or well-known actors. Killer of Sheep, of course, had no professionals in it. And he made it as a student film.
Incredible movie, Los Angeles.
Yeah,
Is he living in Los Angeles still?
Yeah. So he came in for, the Film Society Lincoln Center showed a restored version of To Sleep with Anger, because I'm sure Killer Sheep had already been restored, is my guess. And maybe The Glass Shield, but I know To Sleep with Anger was definitely restored.
Was it a 2K or a 4K?
I don't, that's a good question. Maybe, I think probably 4K, but I can't be certain. But anyway, long story short is they ended up doing a retrospective since they had this film. It's probably not enough to make a big, to warrant bringing in Charles. And so they ended up doing this weekend-long retrospective where they showed all of his films. And the thing is that it's hard not to talk about is, okay, The Glass Shield came out in 1994. That's 22 years ago. Not like, you know, how do you talk about, well, what are you doing?
Yeah, how's he holding up? What is he up to?
I mean, he's got lots of ideas and projects, and you know, and he wants to he's approached about doing stuff. I wouldn't be surprised, as I said in my intro, if he had something soon.
Adam, what's been something you've learned trying to book people on your show? Are you surprised by people who agree to do it or the people who don't agree to do it? What have you learned in that process?
Thank you, Mike Lacy, one of my two guests tonight, the other being Cole Smithy, the co-host of La Grande Bouffe, The Big Feast, a weekly podcast, drops on Fridays, I believe,
mm-hmm.
correct? Check it on Stitcher, iTunes,
and SoundCloud, etc. Yeah, I got to get mine on YouTube and SoundCloud. By the way, YouTube I hear is good too for just the audio
file.
YouTube,
darn it, yeah.
I just don't have it. How do you do that?
I mean, you just to do yourself, make an account.
I just gotta Google it.
Take a nice photo of you.
Yeah,
Google it.
Yeah. To answer your question, booking guests. It is like an albatross.
Full-time job.
It is. I would certainly be more effective if I could devote a lot more time to it. Charles Burnett, for instance, couldn't. I mean, if I told you it was late at night in New York, I have IMDb Pro. I looked him up because he's somebody I've wanted on since I started. I met Charles Burnett when they had a MoMA retrospective about 4 years ago. And I met him then because he's so approachable. I mean, he's just a regular guy, right? And they showed, it was a very expansive retrospective of showing a lot, you know. And I went to see a couple of things. And so, and I think I must have already started my show because I think I was like trying to figure out. And he may have even given me his email back then. Anyway, long story short is that finally I'm like, I got to get him back on. I had saw that he was doing this thing, that Film Society was doing something. I emailed her. She said, you just contact his agent or whatever, because, and ask. And so I think that's what it was, I think. Or I just looked him up and had his agent's phone number or email. And I emailed his agent. Within 10, 15 minutes, I didn't hear back from the agent. I heard back from Charles Burnett.
Beautiful. Maybe he had agent, like a certain president.
And then I got an email. Yeah. And then I hear it from his agent saying, you expect an email from Charles. I said, I already got it. So anyway, he said, yes, let's do it. Now, then it just came like we emailed back and forth for a while, and then it turned out that he said, as soon as I get in, I have a little time. So I literally was like, I got to his hotel moments after he, you know, registered, and it was great. But it's really weird. There's no telling. I wish I could say I'm not at the level to get, obviously, certain names, but sometimes it just happens, and then really all of a sudden, oh, John Turturro's available, and, you know, and then he's really available and he's really there. And then other times, you know, you're just asking for like some, you know, fair to Midland level actor or somebody, and they just, you know, you're rejected. I don't know. I think I have a track record, but
you certainly have, you've been prolific, but you're at 380 something. How many podcasts have you done?
Today's was 383.
Wow.
Yeah. But first of all, I've been doing it for 4-5 years. My audience has heard this before. When I started Film Wax Radio, it was actually not a podcast. It was part of an internet radio platform called Bebox.
Internet radio.
Yeah. So you had to expect people to tune in at a particular time, like terrestrial radio. And I'm thinking to myself, nobody's tuning in to my show. So I was on it like, you know, 3 on Tuesdays and repeated on Fridays at, you know. It was ridiculous. So
this was on like Real Player or like things that have gone the way of the dinosaurs.
No, they had by the time this started, which was in 2011, Bebox, they were actually, funny enough, you know where the Alamo Draft House is, right, in downtown Brooklyn? Have you been there yet, Cole?
Have not been there, okay. But I am looking forward to going.
Yeah. Well, that property where it is the same property where there was something called the DeKalb Market. And it was there a few years ago, and it was a beer garden, but it was all these repurposed storage containers that were repurposed into food carts and into little boutique shops and whatnot. They carved out windows, you know, they put in plumbing or in electricity into these storage containers, the kind you see
in
railroad yards and in shipyards. What?
Not a fire hazard.
No. It was all had to be code.
Cool.
Yeah. So it was great.
I'm with you there.
I love this.
That sounds kind of sketchy to me.
Look up, Google DeKalb Market.
Google it.
They had so many cultural things going. They had so many community events, and I was approached.
I miss it already.
Wonderful. I'm wondering, one of those carts.
That sounds like more of a cultural community center than Alamo Draft House.
Yeah, you're plugging the hell out of this place. And it's not corporate anymore.
No, I know. But the Bebox got one of these carts, and they... So there was a recording studio. Now, most of the hosts for the shows were DJs who put together like salsa show for a half hour. or somebody else had a vintage hip-hop hour, you know, something like that. Mm-hmm. They were great. And I met so many neat people, and it was a very diverse crowd. And they approached me about doing, because I went there to see if I could do an outdoor screening. I got there before Rooftop. And they said, you know, you should do a talk show with local filmmakers to plug your film series, because I was also doing a film series in the neighborhood or nearby. So I thought I started it as a way of promoting my film series. But within weeks, I realized I'm just going to start inviting people I know, like Brandon Harris and Sophia Tikal and, you know, Scott McCauley and people that I had already met or run into. And I didn't know what I was really – I wasn't very good. I mean, I was okay. The bones were there. But I don't like those shows too much. But they were essentially, I started a half hour a week for a little while. And then I'm like, I'm here. I'm coming all this way. Let me book two half-hour shows back to back. So I did that. So for a good solid year or two, I had, you know, with some exceptions, some weeks, I was doing two half-hour shows. So when I repurposed it into a podcast, I took all those episodes and I called each half-hour one show, which is, you know, really was what it was. So I quickly accumulated in a year, if let's say I did two a week for, let's say, even two-thirds of the year, that's a lot of shows. So that's why. And then, you know, again, now 3-4 years gone by since then, and I, of course, accumulated a lot of shows. And even though I mostly do a week, sometimes I'll do two in a week because I just overextended myself, over-obligated my, you know, in terms of time like somebody has a Kickstarter or a movie opening, and I have to get the show up, and I can't do a three-hour show. So I break it into two different shows or something like that, you know. I might get rid of it.
Well, we just had a buddy of mine who's just an all-out film lover, Matt Blankman. And I have to say, you know, he was the sixth guest that we've had on the show. Yeah. We've kind of been experimenting and going the same route that you have started out, where we just, you know, anyone that we know and like,
yeah,
we have. I like, you were our first guest.
Oh, right.
That's you were our debut guest.
I can't imagine. And I've seen you've had, well, I know you had on Armand White. I recently became
He did a great piece, by the way, about Bertolucci. There's been this
controversy on the show, by the way.
Oh my, yes, of course. Love Bertolucci.
Bertolucci's been on my podcast, and
my heart sank when all of this fake news hit the lines about Bertolucci and
what
how
happened?
They supposedly, you know, they framed it as though he sexually abused Maria Schneider. And I mean, we all know the story because I remember growing up in Richmond, Virginia, when Last Tango in Paris was at the Capitol Cinema. Mm-hmm. I can't remember what street it was on. It was there for years. I mean, it was Last Tango in Paris, rated X, blah blah blah. And I have to say, Armand's piece that he did for Out Magazine is phenomenal. He really sets the record straight, and it's so well written, and it's so informative.
Gonna give a shout out to my friend Emily Marthay at Broadly, who did a great piece of like female perspectives and filmmaking and on this film and this controversy. And I feel like what we're getting.
Wait, her name is really Marthay?
Well, it's actually
that's really something.
Well, no, I mean when you're. Cool. Well, what I feel like we're about to launch into is what our dynamic is a bit of being having a yes. minor difference of generations and then perspectives, just minor. Cole, you're 29.
Cole
and I are the same age.
Yeah, I always cheat older. I'm really 33.
Okay, yeah.
Jesus, wait, was Jesus 33?
32, I think.
When he died,
I think he was 32.
I thought he made it to 33.
No, I think he was.
Did he? No, maybe it was 33. What do I know?
This is. I want to get
Jesus
back.
Freaking Christ.
But no, I was just plugging my friend's story, which was she's writing for Broadly about the female perspective and in Hollywood related to this, you know, you'll call it fake news, we'll call it a rediscovered scandal, an issue. But, I mean, these are the kind of things we wind up arguing about, like, fairly consistently. And, I mean, one thing I'll say is both, like, I have, like, these genuine reactions, but then also I say this on a lot of shows is this is gonna blow up on my Twitter. I basically don't have a Twitter, but I think what's interesting is being someone who's on a podcast, which we're still growing. There's not a tremendous number of people listening to it yet, but I'm aware of people's reaction to what I'm saying and the opinions that I'm putting out there in a way that it's not that you don't think about what people would think, but you have a certain a boldness of right. wanting to go a place, and I have what I think is a very generational thing of okay. being very aware of what people right. will say and running through that filter. And I think
I'm that way.
Degree,
I think I was brought up as in the film, independent film world, where you're taught to be nice, where you don't cut down independent films, because this is part of that whole mind frame I'm getting to, which also includes what you're talking about being non-confrontational. Now, Armand White, on the spectrum, you have Armand White on one end. I wouldn't put myself on the other, because I will.
He's the most non-confrontational, right? He's the end of just teddy bear, exactly. like never well, cutting yeah. into people.
He's the Wilson Morales of film
that?
Criticism.
Obscure, obscure reference.
He's a guest. Know. He's a guest that we had on the show. He's the editor of blackfilm.com.
I think okay. Wilson's...
Well, Wilson took me to task because I was at the Fox Searchlight party a few weeks ago, which I missed you at.
I was supposed to be there.
I was looking for you.
I wanted to come. It was for the Birth of the Nation, Birth of a Nation, and
only two
and
films.
Jackie.
Yeah, pretty bad year for Fox Searchlight.
Well, last year they only had in the party. They only
I think they had four last
no,
year.
No, no. Oh, okay. I only thought it was just the what's his name? The Sorrentino.
No, they had
because remember Fonda was there and Michael Caine was there and what's his name? The guy.
Yeah,
the
youth.
Youth.
Yeah, Paul Dano.
Paul Dano. Who was wonderful.
Oh, he's so
wonderful
terrific.
Actor.
Love him. Would love to have him on the podcast. But,
me too.
So we're standing there, you know, at the bar, and Darren Aronofsky walks up. And so we both just immediately, like, lasers right.
Was he wearing a scarf?
He was wearing a scarf.
Yeah.
And a little taller than I remember.
Oh, he's tall.
And I kind of lit into him about Jackie because I just think it's a horrible movie.
Oh, and it's made like already everybody's topped.
Hey, it was despicable. And Wilson wanted to tell a story about how he stood in line for 30 minutes in Toronto to see the movie, and so we had to suffer Wilson's very bland commentary for a half minute.
Well, I mean, that's neither a compliment or a criticism.
Like, exactly. So so if you don't have something to say, you know, why are you here? So but then he took me to task for taking Aronofsky to task. And I was fortunate. I caught the last 4 months of the Kennedy administration, so it's something that I hold near and dear. And I just feel like this is the movie's political exploitation. And I kind of read him the Riot Act on I didn't hold back, and I didn't feel any trepidation about doing it. And we had a great conversation with Aronofsky, and I could tell that he kind of dug it, especially when I told him that I thought Portman was a lot better in his movie.
Oh yeah, yeah.
You should have seen the grin on his face when I said
that. Sure. No, and she was. I don't know what it is. I feel like. I don't know. I wonder if you're listening and you have comments about this, about my personality, because I you're always going to be down on yourself for something. And it's not like I avoid controversy, but I've said things in my intros and I've removed them when I edit them because
we don't edit.
I know.
Do we, Mike?
It doesn't
not much.
Sound like you do. Because you guys are by the end of it, you're like, what movie are we talking about?
Yeah.
I can't remember the name of it.
We really do virtually no editing. And I'm on the fence because
you have Tourette's, so that's really rather impressive because you'll say
I keep it together.
Cunt, all of a sudden in the middle of a
excuse me.
I think you're talking about the philosopher Immanuel
Kant. Kant.
That's actually not a curse word, to be fair.
Yeah, but he was a pussy. So just to set the record straight. Well, I just want to. So I guess I have a little bit because I mean, I don't invite people on who I know are going to be difficult or going to be obnoxious. I like to bring on people who want to really have a nice talk and really be genuine. And I've had a couple of people on that I wouldn't invite them out. No.
Name names.
I will offline.
Okay.
Sure, I'll tell you. Somebody I would not bring back on. And then there are just some. But when just to get back to the booking thing, which also ties in. Another component that you guys are talking about. You brought on Armand. You brought on also another critic, I believe.
Thelma Adams.
Well, Thelma, who's been on this show too. And then I thought there was something. But the matter
Wilson.
Of...
Wilson. Yeah,
Wilson. Thank you. From Black... What is it called?
Blackfilm.com.
I appreciate the diversity. And for me, it's a very important, and I feel like I'm once again on top of my game in that regard, but I will go through months, and if you look on the podcast past episodes, you'll see, you know, it's just week after one white guy, next week that white guy, because it's so easy to book a enough talented white guy. And I love those guys, and they're really great talented.
Well,
but there are a lot of other people that don't fit that description, and I feel like it should reflect the people who are listening. It should reflect where I live. It should reflect the community of film out there.
Let's get into of it is. What's the ease? Is it the ease is that they come to mind first? Is the ease that they're more likely on IMDb
shooting,
Pro?
Shooting what's fish the... in a barrel. No. Well, most of the bookings are coming through relationships I have with publicists.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so you know, just because you guys go to press screenings, I know Cole certainly does. Do you go to press screenings, Mike?
I go through Cole, and I'm on a list now.
Oh,
so
you should
I can,
have no problem.
Okay. I try to avoid press screenings at all costs these days.
Do you?
Yeah, I went I went to see La La Land about a month ago,
yeah.
And I have to say it was a horrible experience. There was some guy in front of me with
at a press screening.
He's just too tall, and I felt like I was sitting in the worst seat in the house. And it was crowded, and I really like online screeners. I have a 75-inch projector, and I'm happy to watch stuff at home.
Right.
And I feel like as a critic, I get to really focus much more on the films. And so I whole thing about online screeners, I have to say I applaud it. I think it's better for the environment, and it's certainly better for me as a critic to do my job. So while I do go to press screenings, I really, this past year, I have consciously avoided them like the plague, and it's been the best year ever.
Okay. It's interesting because I, on the other hand, had a job this summer, which prevented me from really going out. And when I could, I wasn't in the mood. So, and then I kind of enjoyed taking a summer off. By the end of the summer, when I was starting to have the time again, I just was so excited. And I went to see a bunch of movies, and I was really enjoying being in the theater. You know, so I think part of it is probably exhaustion from... the last time I saw you in a movie theater was at The Hateful Eight.
That was about a year ago, yeah.
Yeah.
That was great.
And
that was awesome. That was so good.
Yeah.
That was an exceptional cinematic experience that I really enjoyed. And, don't get me wrong, I'm happy to go buy a movie ticket and go see a movie at 10 or 11 o'clock in the morning with an audience of 8 and enjoy that experience. I don't feel any obligation to the publicist about what I think of the movie.
No.
And
right. You got to get out of that, otherwise you'll end up in your 70s at round tables, which is
it's a slippery slope.
Very few publicists, they don't know me very well, ask me if I'll do it. How can I do a round table? First of all,
you don't write reviews.
No, right, but even if I want right. But first of all, round tables are an utter waste of time.
Can you break down a round table for me? I kind of know what it is, but
there's one-on-one.
Oh, I love this discussion. Let's do it. Let's
there's
do it.
One-on-one interviews, which is how I have to do mine because, of course, I can't have other people sitting
Hallelujah.
At the table. I can't have other people asking questions at my table. And then there's also a level of intimacy I'm trying to establish, which I can't do if I have other people, even if I could edit them out. So there's that. The other thing, and
we have to address what a round table
is. I'm going to get to that.
Okay.
But when I get in a room with somebody who may have had their 10th, 20th, 30th interview, and they just think I'm going to be another person asking the three marketing questions that they've been asked already, and then I sit with them, and within minutes,
What attracted you to this project?
Well, or whatever the question is.
How long have you wanted to kiss Ryan Gosling?
Yeah.
Who are you
well,
dating?
Well, I actually do want to know that. Anyway,
that's one of your standard openers, I've
sure,
heard.
It is.
What's your favorite color?
Well, that would probably be a refreshing call for some of these people. But
I have to say, I spent 4 minutes of my life recently listening to Valley Girl the other day just because I had to. It came to my mind. That's right. The song Valley Girl. And
Let's cut to it. It
was so satisfying. Frank Zappa still, he may not be with us anymore, but he's still with us.
We're going to cut to Valley Girl.
Valley Girl. She's a Valley Girl. Valley Girl. She's a Valley Girl.
And we're back. That is a great song. Okay, round table.
I'm really hoping you didn't just cut
they're
to
pr-
it.
You know what a press day is? Like yeah. Do like you know what a press day is?
I know what a junket is.
Gag me with a spoon.
Press junket is the same thing. So you go to...
I've been a cameraman at a press junket. I was once a cameraman for a Reese Witherspoon thing. Which I'll say one thing about Reese Witherspoon. She's more pretty in real life.
It's hard to imagine.
She's aging really pretty. Well.
She is aging.
So is Angelina Jolie.
Let's just talk about who I think is pretty, guys.
That's a conversation.
You said Angelina Jolie,
but there's something to be surprised because she's...
who do you think is really pretty? Adam.
Ryan Gosling, hands down.
Jake Gyllenhaal, what a handsome man.
Yeah, fine features. It's right.
I'll go with the Fassbender.
He's a good looking guy.
Yeah.
No.
Michael Fassbender.
I don't know. I thought you were talking about the filmmaker.
He's been dead for about 40 years.
I was worried there. The thing about the
corpse is not looking good.
Famous actors, I don't really get to see a lot of. I don't go to a lot of these things where, like, if I go to a press junket and I get a one-on-one, which is what I demand, they'll give me the director. They often don't give me an actor because
you don't get the lookers. I'm not writing for the Hollywood Reporter.
Who's the main actor from Arrested Development? It's killing me. I'm trying to come up with
Bateman.
That's right.
Jason Bateman.
They're on YouTube. You can go on YouTube and just type in Jason Bateman about round tables. And he had just come out of a round table, and he's reading the Riot Act about who are these homeless people.
Yeah, that's exactly
what the publicists do. They bring in these people. They carry bags into the room. And they ask questions like, "What attracted you to this?"
And then they ask to take pictures with them.
Oh, yes, they do, and autographs and every other thing. And I could not be associated with those people. I went through a phase where I was doing roundtables.
Well, you have to. At the beginning, you do that because the publicists don't know you, and you have to do it for a little while, and you carry yourself in such a way. But they don't serve that you cannot get – even if you're a journalist and you're writing – maybe if you're writing like a tiny piece – you get a soundbite. You can include other people's as long as you don't give yourself the credit for having asked the question.
Oh, I always did.
All right.
Okay. I always did.
I have to call the publicist, please.
And I also rewrote the questions because they were so poorly enunciated to begin with. I would write the question that fit the response.
You know, even at the worst than the bag people. Are the overly familiar though the ones that?
Oh, last time we were together, I met you and blah blah blah, and we said this and you said that, and your drawers were drooping.
Yeah, I'm gonna get you the restaurant's phone number. Give me your email, and they're like, oh, they're it's true. This the round, but the round table, you know, you're sitting there with people who nobody's writing for anything. Nobody's writing for anything legitimate. I mean, I don't care what they say.
If they say
they're writing for People magazine, People is spelled with two E's or something. It's okay.
Lizard.
It maybe it's Pibble magazine about pit bulls, but it's not, you know.
So, yeah, the film criticism world is a bit, it's becoming a little more filled in to me, but it's a bit obscure to me still. You know, sure. I'm on this podcast with Cole, who's a film critic, and...
It's called Le Grand Boeuf.
It's called Le Grand Boeuf.
Interrupt yourself for a moment, since we're back around this subject of your podcast, and just quickly tell everyone what the podcast is about.
So every week, Mike and I get together, and we copiously consume international politics and culture through the prism of a single film and a different craft beer every week. That's our motto. That's what we do.
That's your elevator.
And, yeah, that's our thing. And we met in Cannes a year and a half ago, and Mike was doing...
That's what I wanted to know about,
too. He was producing videos for the American Pavilion in Cannes, and Emma Griffith was heading up the organization and managing... But she was managing the pavilion, and for PR, and managing the workers there, as it were. And Mike and I met, and then we ended up hanging out at the airport waiting for our plane back. And it took almost a year for us to – or maybe actually more than a year for us to finally get together for beers. And somehow the idea of a podcast came up, and we set that thing in motion pretty soon thereafter.
Yeah, Colin's the good log line on it. But how I've been thinking about really what we're doing is those two kind of – pretentious guys that are shouting at a bar and referencing anything they can think of and what they've seen on the news lately, and I read, and then you pull up some movie you saw 30 years ago or a book that you're talking about. It's kind of what we're doing is it's I think it's like an authentic conversation that you'll see, and we like to bring people into it, and we like to have some sort of structure to it based on a movie, and then we both like beer, and Cole's a little bit more of an expert even than well, I wouldn't call myself an expert about beer. I still struggle every week to figure out how to talk about how I feel about it. And we have this untapped asset, which is your wife. I'm still waiting for your wife to teach me how to talk about
or how to talk
beer in a coherent way.
At all after drinking beer. Sometimes.
So as I've been called out a few times, I may be a lightweight. Both in just like I'm not the largest person. Did you know this fact about me? So I worked on a movie at one point when I was living in Nashville, and they called me in on a day I wasn't supposed to be working, and they were like, "Hey, Mike, you do anything today?" And I was like, "Well, I got to be working at a restaurant at like 7, but what's going on?" And they're like, "We need a stand-in," and I was like, "Cool. Does it pay?" And they're like, "Oh yeah, totally. Yeah, just wondering." Are you cool with being a stand-in? And I'm wondering, like, yeah, it's fine, whatever. And you're like, okay, cool. I just want you to know who you're being a stand-in for, so you're like, you're cool with that? And I was like,
Reese Witherspoon.
Okay.
Because she's from Nashville.
I wish. I was like, yeah, now who am I being a stand-in for? Like, have you seen Seinfeld? And I was like, yeah, I've seen Seinfeld. So who is this? So I'm like, so who am I being a stand-in for? Is this Jason Alexander? What's going on? Come on, tell me. And they're like, okay, you remember Kramer's friend? And I was like, who's no. And like the little guy?
Newman?
Like the little guy? Like his acting partner?
Newman?
No, like the little person? Like the person who's a little person? Like the 3'5" little person that he was friends with?
They're basically saying you're Hervé Villechaize. Can you insult me a little bit more, by the way?
So I was a stand-in for a little person who was 3'8". His name was Mickey on the show.
Okay.
There's an episode where Kramer's there's a couple.
Is he on more than one episode?
He's on a few episodes.
Okay.
Yeah, but it's a very like.
I don't have my device with me.
Saying like, have you seen Seinfeld? And do you remember this one little person on the show? Mm-hmm. It's a leap. But any case, so I come to the set. I fill in for him. The DP is like, "You're doing great." And I'm like, well, I gotta go. I find my friend, this woman who's the exact same height as me, and I say, "Hey, can you do this for me? Like, I gotta go." She fills in. The second she walks on set, I'm leaving set. I hear the DP go, "You're way too tall, woman. Get out of here. You can never do it." So something about me screams extremely short.
All right,
That's the point of that whole.
All right,
but I just wanted to say that you know we're very eclectic. If I was to say anything about Le Grand Bouffe, The Big Feast, is that we really revel in discovering films. Some films that we've seen before, but Matt Blankman introduced us to Cutter's Way, which I didn't know anything about, and Jeff Bridges, John Hurt, amazing movie, really great movie. And
it had a different title originally.
It was Bone and Cutter, or Cutter and Bone,
right.
Originally.
Yeah.
It really is a couple of film loving gorehounds who are just seeking out some really cool ass movie to talk about, and drinking a beer and talking
right.
about it.
Right. Yeah. So. Yeah, and sometimes the beer wins, sometimes the movie wins. You never know.
The beer usually kicks my ass. It's kind of my
I know because you're small. Is that what you're trying to? But no, but Cole wouldn't be described as small. But he also I can hear sometimes you can tell he's losing.
I think you pregame, Cole. I think you're holding out on me.
No, I think
The thing is sometimes I will have a beer before Mike gets there just to hedge it. You know,
you're lubricated.
Oh yeah, just to get a running start. You know, in honor of Mike.
Oh, so you're even, kind of like
exactly. So we're starting up.
So he's not so handicapped.
That's right.
I see. Very good.
I really appreciate that, man.
Yeah, we're cool like that.
Interesting, because what I note in some episodes is you will just start forgetting titles, actors' names.
Oh yeah, I couldn't believe it. You know, we had not even because of the alcohol. I kept calling the long goodbye the last goodbye, and finally Matt Blankman set me straight in this.
People will do that,
and I'm glad that he did, because the name of the film is The Long Goodbye.
You know, I got into an argument with Dan Nuxel. Do you know Dan?
No, who is that?
Runs this.
Oh, he runs Rooftop Films.
Yeah,
arguments are fun.
And somebody came up to us. We were at a party. And so, recently, maybe a month ago, if that, and somebody came up to us and said, what's your favorite Altman film? And I said, Long Goodbye. And Dan got really like, it's not a good movie. He said it was just a lazy Altman.
He is not a film lover. That person is not a film lover. Well, but he's not an Altman lover. I don't know what to say.
He said his favorites were definitely Nashville. The Gosford Park he thought was exceptional. Well, I agree. I love that movie.
Great movie.
And what was the other one he mentioned? Because I'm like...
The Player?
No. No. Yeah, but I don't think The Player is that great.
It's a fun movie.
I like the first half of The Player. My favorites would be Long Goodbye, Nashville, necessarily. And then I guess I want to say McCabe and Mrs. Miller has got to be in there. I love that one. And I just watched Three Women again just a few days ago. Have you seen that? Have you seen Three Women?
Yeah, I love it. Great movie.
That could be one. That we talked about.
I've not seen it.
I have a copy. It's from, it was recently released on the Criterion Collection, but the most recent one was McCabe and Ms. Miller. Mm-hmm. And then I guess also I love.
Well, MASH is terrific.
Really terrific. It always pays you back every time you watch it. There's always something great.
But for neo noir, I think the Long Goodbye and also casting against type, having Elliot Gould, this Jew, this tall Jewish character.
Everybody's type.
As the Raymond Chandler. But
everyone is cast against type.
Against type. It's
Henry
beautiful.
Henry Gibson is
and
cast.
And Vilmos Zsigmond, the cinematographer. It's a beautiful movie to look at. Look at that movie all day.
It is. It has its flaws, but that's part of what makes a great movie.
Movies have flaws. Hello.
But I would say, but if the relationship between Sterling Hayden and Henry Gibson is totally both against type. It's this, you know, small
Henry Gibson is so Napoleon. Damn good. Not to mention Sterling Hayden, of course.
Yeah, I mean they're just both. Yeah, I mean
Sterling Hayden,
you know,
again. It's McCluskey, right? We were just talking about him on our show.
Right,
it's McCluskey. From
yes,
the Godfather.
From The Godfather. That's right. But also he was in Doctor Strangelove
and
my Bob
Bertolucci's 1900, my favorite film of all time.
That's your favorite movie?
That is my
What makes it your favorite?
What is it, like 3 hours and 45 minutes or 4 hours and 15
minutes? Well,
it depends
which cut you see, right? It's one of those films.
Well, I saw the big cut. The first time I saw it, I was living in San Francisco. I think I saw it in probably 87 and at the Castro Cinema. And it changed my life. It was my introduction to Gerard Depardieu. And, of course, Donald Sutherland is in it. And it's the Belle Epoque. It's the turn of the century, obviously, in Italy, and it addresses the coming Mussolini's fascism is coming in the door, and the generational shifts are happening, and so there's this battle between these two brothers, one who's lower class, and of course the other who's who becomes the padrone of the property, and you really, I could watch it again right now. There's just so much scope, social and political and personal.
Let's
scope
cut to the trailer.
And then it ends on this really elegant note between they're not brothers, but they're like blood brothers. These two characters, Robert De Niro's character. And also seeing Robert De Niro just work with Gerard Depardieu and Donald Sutherland. And Burt Lancaster too. Burt Lancaster is amazing. His role doesn't last that long in the film, but
I thought he was in The Leopard.
He's also in The Leopard. Yeah, yeah. Okay.
There were all these American actors who were doing Italian films back in the '70s.
Yeah, but Robert De Niro was flying back and forth and shooting Taxi Driver and then flying to Italy and shooting...
Was De Niro in Taxi Driver? I'm just kidding.
And shooting 1900.
It's funny because with Bertolucci, I've seen 1900, but my favorite, you know, is probably The Conformist. I know it's everybody's. Or The Last Tango. So I Skyped with him. And
with
he is
Bertolucci? Last
movie. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Bernardo.
Was he good at Skype?
He talked about Brando, but the audio quality was frustrating. But he did to give some Brando, you know, references, you know, to talk with Bertolucci about Brando on my little crummy podcast.
Did he have a nickname for him? Did he call him Marlon? Did he call him Marty? Did he have, like, you know, like,
Marty,
I love those little, you know, everyone's
Marty. people, you know, call, people talk about Martin Scorsese, Marty.
Yeah, they call him Marty. They talk about Bob De Niro, Bobby. You know, just like Bobby, you know. Yeah. Like, when you're on set with Bobby, you know, it's not like, it's, you know, it's not like the big guy on the screen. It's like your friend, you know. He's, you know, that little, how many of them are pretending they have that relationship?
I'm sure many.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's very true. It's very true.
Your dog is adorable. I don't know if it's picking up.
She's 14 years old, and she's an old grand dame now.
Is that a...
she's lost a lot of her teeth, so her tongue can't stay in her mouth.
Still, is she still beautiful? Is she a King Charles? What kind of dog is she? She's a King Charles Cavalier.
Yeah,
yeah.
Well, we can go to the photo on the. We'll post a photo on our film on the Facebook page, so you can see Lucy, what she looks like. So yeah, and I feel like I'm playing one of those spinning wheels in a casino. What do they call those?
Roulette. Oh, the
roulette wheel. Thank you. And I'm landing back on the publicist chip or whatever, because I want to just kind of put that. I love, there are certain publicists I really love. Most of them are really nice, but the whole...
Well, you're dealing with independent publicists, and they're awesome. The Hollywood publicists are all snotty, and they don't give you any support. And I really wonder why, why anyone even bothers with them, because they don't do their job is the problem. The publicist's function is to give you support as a journalist. They're supposed to support you.
Well,
they're supposed to reach out to
Hollywood. What they're doing is filtering. They're protecting their client, is what you're saying. In New York, or in when it's a publicist on a film project, not a personal publicist, then they're trying to promote the film. And some believe, let me get anybody, just about anybody, not this homeless person, but just about anybody else, because it's all good publicity if they like the film. And then some are a little less so. And the frustrating thing is like, I have a special relationship with a couple of different publicity firms who I've done so many films, where they've asked me to cover certain films themselves because they're not getting as much publicity. And if they're good films, I say, yeah, I will do it. But there is a quid pro quo underlying, which I'm going to say right now. It's just business. When you go to a store, you make a purchase, it's a quid pro quo. You're getting a good or service, and you're paying money. So it's a transaction. So if a publicist says, can you cover this film for us or talk to this director, unless it's really bad, I always say I have to see it first, but yes, I mean, let me watch it and I'll do it.
I like that you're ethical about that, because there's a lot of people who wouldn't even say that. They would just take it because and I did want to give a shout out to Bruno Dumont, because I videotaped an interview that you did with Bruno Dumont, and his film Malut that I saw in Cannes this year is on my top 10 list.
Yeah, I heard of good things.
Yeah.
Last one was a... Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
That one we were talking about, which was the little cancan. What was it called? It was...
Le Petit Cancan.
It was this really long, unusual film, but it was really fantastic. But quite a departure from the body work.
And he writes that stuff. That guy's got an imagination that won't quit. Yeah. He's really got an incredible imagination, guy.
But unfortunately, we just got him.
He was jet-lagged that morning.
He seemed really out of it. You know, because I'm sure he's more dynamic than he came off. And yeah, and his English wasn't as strong as it probably was if he was on more rested. And so it wasn't exactly set up for a great interview, whatever. I'm still a big fan of his work. I mean, some of his films are really disturbing.
Yeah, I saw him in Cannes. We walked right past each other, and then he sat across from me in the aisle in a screening. And so, you know, but every time... I wasn't going to, you know, mess with the guy, but I just, you know, I have a warm feeling about him, because he really makes interesting movies. He's one of those filmmakers who really puts everything on the line.
Yeah. Yeah.
Can I ask kind of a basic question to you guys, just like a genuine question about film criticism and about the journalism surrounding the industry? Is like, generally, if you want to do anything, you know, you want to make a big casino or something, you get people interested, you get the word out there, you hire a publicist. Is there something different about film or like art in general where your publicity is coming from people who are going to critique you on this level that has to do with art and its meaning on like a human level? So is the nature of the relationship between people making it and trying to get people to see it and get people to pay money for it different when they're engaging with critics versus just like journalists.
Well, critics should be considered part of the journalism community, right? They are. So some of the journalists are covering in a critical way, and others are just covering it in a more
entertainment vein as a news story.
This is happening. These are the facts about the event or the what have you. And
Jim Jarmusch? Just a question.
No, he popped into my mind. There's a short list of people that I'm dying to bring on, and even though he's had two films,
because he's a New Yorker, right?
He lives here, and I've certainly had my share of events that I've been in the same room with him.
Have you seen Patterson?
Yes.
What'd you think?
Yeah, it was okay.
I really liked it. It made my top 10.
Oh, okay. I did like it. I feel like it was my Jarmusch threshold might be different than, but I liked it. I'm glad I went to see it. I went out of my way to see it in a press screening, and I was glad I did. It feels lightweight. You know, I didn't feel like it was very deep, but
well, I think it's minimalist, but
sure.
But
very spare.
It's very poetic, and I really appreciate what he did with the poetry in that movie.
Yeah. That's true. And yeah, there's a very heartbreaking moment in that film.
That involves a dog.
It involves a dog. Yeah. And a night out.
Oh boy. You can see it coming.
Does he skip on his bill or something?
Nothing like that.
Wait, it involves the dog.
But have you seen the Iggy Pop documentary?
I did. And I am a huge Iggy Pop fan.
I imagine,
I came to Iggy Pop late. I didn't discover Iggy until I was about 22.
Oh.
And
exactly a kid's musician, so I think 22 is pretty appropriate.
Yeah, college. I was playing drums in a punk rock band and stuff, and so I really prided myself on all of my punk rock knowledge. Yeah. And
but he was more, I always think of him more as a rock star, a rock singer.
Well, he's kind of
on the line there.
No, he was the inspiration for punk. There would be I don't think that the punk rock would have happened if it hadn't been for Iggy and the Stooges.
Yeah.
And so
it doesn't mean they were punk, because punk was invented afterwards, maybe inspired by Iggy Pop.
Well, they were transgressive.
Uh-huh.
And I think that's the real story, is they were so transgressive, and there's nothing that you can compare the Stooges to. You know, the Velvet Underground
Ramones?
Is probably the closest that you can. Yeah, the Ramones came along, you know, 6-7 years later.
Mm-hmm.
About Jarmusch's film, I felt like it wasn't edited right. You hit that point at about 95 minutes where it goes on for 15 more minutes, and you think, wait a minute, aren't we done? Like, isn't it over?
Oh, yeah.
You know, that's weird.
The pace.
That's weird. And then also, I mean, we all, I don't know, I have plenty of Iggy Pop stories about him, you know, begging for money outside a liquor store a half hour after playing a gig in San Diego and stuff. I mean, there's so many great Iggy stories. And I just feel like they didn't let loose. I mean, Iggy was a dangerous person. If you ever went to see Iggy Pop anytime in the 60s or 70s, you know, I mean, you were frightened. It was a scary thing.
60s?
Oh, the Stooges, yeah.
Okay.
And, I mean, you know, if you look at what the Stooges were doing in the 60s compared to the Stones, you know, the Stones were Cinderella.
How old is he now, then?
He's pushing 70.
Yeah, because, I mean, you're talking about 50 years ago.
So what I thought was really missing from the documentary was I wanted to have at least five or six people, you know, whatever, whoever he could get, you know, Scott Thurston or whatever, you know, tell your ultimate Iggy story. What's the bloodiest, nastiest thing that happened?
So what was the general feel?
It was tame.
It was
and how
tame.
can you make the Stooges tame? They were anything but.
Okay.
Is it kind of like how history was affected by them, and there's a way of just talking about the impact of people? Like, I remember these documentaries that I would watch a lot that they did teach me factually about history, but it was like a lot of Bill Clinton talking about Elvis being on Ed Sullivan. And there's something about the former president telling you about how transgressive Elvis was that makes Elvis seem extremely non-transgressive.
Right.
They couldn't show his hips because they was moving back and forth. And it's just like, okay, I feel like I'm not getting how sexy and weird that was.
I read a Rolling Stone magazine. I know the anecdotes, you know. Oh, by the way, when the postage stamp comes out, is it going to be fat Clinton or skinny Clinton?
I thought we were talking about Iggy.
Yeah.
Come on, Iggy. Where's Iggy's postage stamp?
Yeah, that's true.
Where's Fat Iggy? That's what I'm waiting for.
But that's the thing, is there is no Fat Iggy. That's the awesome thing.
Yeah.
And that's why he was never president.
Iggy pop for president 2020. You heard it here first. Mike Lacy.
I bet he could win. Well, yeah, anybody can win.
At this point. And he's the same age as Trump.
They no longer... Is that true?
Yeah.
Oh, that's bizarre.
Roughly.
It's also, that's the criteria now.
One of them wears a shirt, that's all I can say.
That's the criteria, is you be the same age as the person who is currently elected, you seem qualified enough.
I think that is the full story on publicists. You just have to then come through. Once in a while, you don't. You let them know what happened. And, you know, P.S., my postscript on this whole thing about publicists. I really would love to not have to work with publicists, not because, again, I appreciate they're doing their job. Many publicists have got me great guests, but I love, like, Marc Maron, who I know uses some publicists, probably, or his booking persons use. But I just want to invite on one great film person every week and have a nice, long, nuanced conversation. I'm not reinventing the wheel here, and get away from all the other stuff. So what I do is I get the publicists send me emails every day. I get 20 emails from different publicists in the mail, and I go through them as much as I can, and I look to see who's in what film, and sometimes I want that obscure person anyway, so, like, I don't need to get on.
Well, you gravitate to filmmakers over actors, is that right?
Yeah, but I would say that I would have a far many more actors on if I could get them on, so... You know, I try. Sometimes I just aren't
right,
available.
I have to bust out because I was trying to say it earlier. In the half dozen guests that we've had on the show, Matt Blankman, who's just a film lover, introduced us to this great movie, Cutter's Way. Mm-hmm. I personally had so much fun. I had much more fun with Matt than, you know, nothing against everybody else. They're all great. All the guests we've had are terrific. You yourself included, of course. You know, I'm not putting you down here, buddy. I'm not cutting you in the back. Don't get me wrong. I'm just saying, you know, like, he's just a guy. Uh-huh. And it was so much fun.
Yeah.
If I can give advice to anybody who's making their own show or developing their own content, one thing I'd say 30 episodes deep into what we're doing is, you know, be flexible into, like, what you're trying to do. And what I'm finding, and I think, is that we love talking to people in a casual and, like, just real, and I hate to say this as someone who's under 30 years old, but authentic way of just, like, how you actually talk about these things, you know, and to put aside the sort of stuffiness of, like, this sort of pseudo-academic analysis of things, and to be comfortable with, like, shouting about something that you feel, and to, like, putting on the line, like, here's why I hate this, here's why I love this. And that's kind of what I got from the Blankman episode, too, is he's just a guy, you know, and he's... As you were telling me before the show, and it's not in it, it's like he's larger than life. There's something, like, old timey about him, and I love the show to gravitate towards these people that you see in a bar and you see on the street and you just have a casual conversation with, and they have a very passionate relationship with a movie, with a movement, and those are the people that we like having, and I think that's why people love film so much, is that passion. But I, at the same time, I'm so fascinated by the bizarre collection around the film industry, which is not actually the making of the movie, like the publicists and the people who are attached to it, in some ways helping it, in some ways like leeches and like barnacles. Mm-hmm. It's a weird, like, amalgamation which turns into, you know, your 90 to 120 minute things, which we call movies.
Yeah. In order to let people know about films, you need people that are going to do the publicist's work. You need their tentacles.
The reason I'm not covering
Hollywood, or one of the reasons, is because I'm not needed. They don't need me. They've got
They've
got hundreds of millions of dollars invested in posters and ads and, you know,
that
TV time. Yeah. They don't independent
cinema is so much more interesting.
But also my wheelhouse and is the, you know, mid to small budget film made by real people, and thank you
for filling that void, because it is a void.
Well, then I don't make any money at.
But I also, want to ask you. You know, this is like what's your favorite color? You know, it is a question that you want to know. Like, okay, what podcast did you have the most fun?
Oh, that is a hard question because there are so many. That's
what's one of your favorite ones where you really had a where you felt like all the rules were off the table and you were just digging it.
I don't know about that context, but when I walked out feeling really, really like fantastic about it, or just had such a great experience. You know, I wish I could just look at a cheat sheet too, but there have been so many great experiences. Like, even though I was still a little green, and Ken Burns, because his last thing he said was, "Those were great questions." It was one of the first ones I did, like, not in the internet radio studio, that I went out and talked to him, you know, at a press day type of junket. But it was such an incredible thing. And then I just love talking to certain documentary. I love talking to Michael Apted, because the 7-Up films are some of my favorite films of all. And he was a warm. This is a guy who also directed a James Bond film. I mean, he's got a lot of feature narrative films.
I did a telephone interview with him once. Okay. It was.
Yeah.
It's great. Terrific. Yeah. Love Michael Apted. So glad he's still around.
Yes.
Because we're due for another 7-Up pretty soon.
Oh, my gosh. That's right. I'm exactly 7 years younger than them, I think. So that means you are.
I'm born in 63.
Yeah, me too. So we're just 7 years. I think they're all 7 years older than we are.
Yeah.
I think.
So what's the next one? 62 up or something?
63 maybe. 63? 50, what was it? 56 was the last one. 56. So
56. So 63.
63?
Is that? Yeah, 63 up.
Wow. For those
how long is Michael? I mean, Michael Apted's got to be in his 80s.
Does anyone not know what these are that's listening? These are the movies that follow people every 7 years, starting at the age of 7 and then
British.
14 up, 21 up.
Same
collection of Brits. It was a BBC. The first one was a BBC
TV
thing. It was 7-Up, and they found these kids who were 7 years old from various social classes, and they did these interviews with them. And every 7 years now, Michael Apted has returned. Some of them participate. Some of them fall off. Some of them come back. But it is the most complex and consistent social study of British and, you know, going in the meta way that the series has. It has so many more implications for other countries, but it is British-centric, and there's nothing else like it.
Boyhood. No, I'm joking. But we do it. It's a great film, but nothing like that.
Can I...
But
that's somebody I've been pursuing, and I believe I will get. Like Jim Jarmusch, I would like to think I would get, because these are my heroes, but I believe Richard Linklater I could get a little easier than Jim Jarmusch, because Jim Jarmusch is not as famous, but he could have been, but he's just re-entered more of a prolific stage again.
I think Jim Jarmusch he's probably like 85% as famous as Richard.
Yeah,
he's
80 to maybe 75 to 85. Because I would say that there's several more Linklater, purely because of his being more prolific than Jim Jarmusch and a little younger.
Well, and also Hollywood, School of Rock.
Yes, that's right.
And
he's also just, he's Midnight Trilogy and...
Well, that's independent, though. That's an indie thing.
Doesn't matter. I'm saying those movies really are part of the zeitgeist. Can you name any Jarmusch movies that really hit the zeitgeist? Really? I mean, maybe 20, 30 years ago they had, but are they still there? No. I mean, I'm a Stranger in Paradise. You know, I had on, I've spoken to John Lurie, not for the podcast. We've been talking for years. I have a Skype conversation that I can't post, but it is great. I have Richard Edson, and I've had Esther Balint.
I love John Lurie.
Tom DiCillo has been on.
And I feel so awful about the way that he got scammed, really, in that whole debacle that happened with his career, the way he got John Lurie.
Oh, John Lurie?
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm talking about.
Well, I know it's a long, complicated story.
It's so complicated.
Google Tad Friend, New Yorker article. but there's a lot more
ugly.
To it.
Really should never have happened. And the New Yorker, I have to say, they should just like you know close it out, cash it in. They're done. You know, like
that sounds like Donald Trump.
Well, you know the reason is like you know they do
the
like
failing
they do
New
like
Yorker.
They do the like the fake news thing. I don't know if you like you saw the thing like oh Donald Trump hires El Chapo or whatever, and then in the same breath they put this essay about fake news. New Yorker, don't shit where you eat, okay?
Andy Borowitz, shots fired from Cole Smithy over here.
No, seriously. Well, I will say it is a very bougie magazine, which used to be so much, well, back in, I hate to say it under these terms, but when I was very young, the magazine was very quirky and very, just would have like a 30-page article on like a certain type of bird or something, like somebody who was just a crazy birder who was into this particular, you know, species or something. But then it's become a lot more vanilla, mainstream. And then, like, I read this Almodovar purely because MoMA is doing a retrospective.
So overrated.
It is really, first of all, I'm no longer excited about Almodovar. Because
yeah, what's the last good movie that he made? I mean, it was 20 years ago. It's been a long time.
It really has. I mean, he's shifted his tone, which I appreciate, but it's not somebody who, you know, used to keep going and waiting for the next.
Same here.
And then you just yeah, go, it's like Woody up. Allen. I'm sorry, I know you might be fans.
Yeah, no, I gave up.
But I gave up on Woody Allen a long time ago.
Agreed.
And I think he's absolutely one of the worst filmmakers. He went from being my favorite filmmaker growing up to now being somebody I cannot spend another minute of my life wasted on a Woody Allen film.
I couldn't agree more.
You know, he should just have retired 25 years ago.
But the New Yorker wants to have their
And I was defending him on the technicalities about his relation with Sun Yi. I want to let people to know. Well, I think it was still a horrible decision to
Can we all agree it was not a good PR decision?
It was not a good...
We can debate incest and the morality,
there's
but
no
the
incest
PR
when you're sleeping with your girlfriend's adopted daughter. That's not incest. And he never lived in the same... See, these were the things that people kept not... Now, allegations about his behavior with his other children and with all that, it's just stinks. The whole thing stinks. And frankly, you know, I don't think it's his obligation.
Where there's smoke, there's fire.
I don't know. But, I just feel like, but, you know, at least stamp out the fire then, maybe, because it's like the allegations are pretty strong. And then, but all these Hollywood actors flocking to be in these garbage movies that he makes. I'm sorry, and I have friends who really love Woody Allen, and I'm like, listen, right up through Crimes and Misdemeanors, I think this was one of the most incredible careers, considering how prolific he was. And then there have been a handful of great films, good to great films, or at least films with great moments in it.
For me, I think Match Point was his last decent movie.
Okay, that was a decent movie, and that, but, you know.
And that was how many years ago? I mean, that's
20.
Yeah,
I don't know.
Long time.
No. Yeah, but so it was Blue Jasmine, which I think had only a great performance.
Overrated.
It was overrated. I enjoyed it because Cate Blanchett I thought was fantastic and made me really believe, oh, this is how somebody goes crazy and talks.
I'll praise the director who makes Cate Blanchett suck, though, because that person is interesting. Cate Blanchett couldn't
that's a good
suck
point.
If. No. Her life depended on it.
I have to say that one of my most pleasurable memories was when I was doing a round table and I was early. I got there a half hour early and Cate Blanchett walked into the room 20 minutes early. And it was just she and I sitting in the room for 20 minutes. And she's flawless.
Feasting her eyes on you, man.
You flatter me, sir. It was the other way around. And she was just such a well-spoken artist. She's a true artist. There's
Carol
no
is a great film.
She's a terrific artist. No
Did
question.
You see Carol?
I love Carol. What was my top? Oh, my top 10 last
year.
Oh,
very good. Yeah. I don't do top tens because
I don't do top tens anymore either. I do best 10.
Oh. Yeah. I can't do lists, though, because I have on guests and I can't. It's part of the thing. It's like, how do you invite on people and then just like make a list and, leave them people out? And
I'm glad you said that because I think this kind of addresses Mike's question earlier. And what I've come to realize, I mean, you've been in this world for a long time. I'm hitting my 20th year in it. And
longer than me.
And what I've come to realize is that, you know, you make your own path. So, you know, it is what you make it.
Again, I'm not a critic, but if I might do more of that type of, when I, and I was, I started that way. I was working in the music industry, and then I left in like 96.
You worked for Sony, right?
Yes, Sony Music. And then I went into film. Like, I always wanted to write about film. I don't know what. Anyway, so I started writing reviews, and I realized pretty quick, oh, no, I learned how to do it, but I realized I'm not special at it. I would rather read other people, so why would I want people to read my writing? But I wrote about 100 articles, you know, as a reviewer, thinking maybe I'll join the New York Film Critic or whatever it is, Circle. Because I think you had to have like 100 printed or published reviews.
Well, I have a story about that, and it goes very quickly.
Yeah.
Because, Paul, for the New York Film Critics Circle, you have to have a sponsor. And so it was Pauline Kael who sponsored Armand White into that group. But Armand tried to sponsor me into that group.
I see.
And so what happens...
But he got kicked out.
Well, this is before that.
Oh, okay.
But once you get sponsored, then the rest of the group gets to vote about whether they want you or not. And they're like, smartest film critic in the world? No.
Oh, they thought you were too cocky.
Evidently.
Yeah.
Yeah, that branding is a mixed bag, man.
Well, you know, it's the other one who does that is Greg Proops,
in the
comedian.
Yeah,
he's the smartest comic in the world or something.
Yeah, in the words of Iggy Pop, a heavy price for a heavy pose.
So you're sticking with it. That's good to know.
So one thing that we get into on our podcast, because we kind of indulge ourselves with being able to be wasted, is that we can go to like very large, grand places and opinions. And so, like, you know, to kind of hit that place right now is, like, one thing that I love about the place in which you are in the film industry is it's essentially, like, the middle-level films, you know, the lower to middle-level films, which actually need the attention. Like, as you were saying before, Hollywood doesn't need any help. Yeah. Hollywood, actually, what they're trying to do on a publicity level is to filter out people that they don't want. Because they want exactly the kind of PR that they want.
Yeah, they have already what they want you to say and do. So, like, if somebody goes, you have 10 minutes with Cate Blanchett, I'll say, thanks, no thanks. That's not my show. Everybody pretty much knows that. But once in a while, they'll get that. Or, will you do a roundtable? No, I don't do roundtables. I can't, you know. Those are the things. So, this is my show. This is how I do my show. If you can't do it, that's fine. Thank you. You know.
Hollywood, in some ways, is kind of like...
I'm not going to be a mouthpiece.
Like
for
a projection of the... Like in the, and so this is where I'm talking about us being able to be drunk and to talk about things on how it's like the American economy, man. There's no middle class of it. But this is one thing that, as a regular person who had a very lucky chance to go to the Cannes Film Festival, what I was seeing is that most of the world doesn't get to go to a Hollywood and pitch their movie to some Katzenberg that's going to greenlight their $100 million movie. They go to Germany, and then they go to France, and they go here, and they go there, and they cobble together a couple million dollars. And that
Look at Paul Verhoeven with L, which was my second favorite film of the year. And that's exactly what he did. And he's Paul Verhoeven.
Yeah, and so these are the kind of movies that,
well,
you know, be they foreign, be they American.
You can't help it.
But it's a tragic thing that you can't go to. Paul Verhoeven, who's making like giant Hollywood movies, has to put together these budgets. And these are the exact kind of movies that need this attention and that need to be brought up, because it would be great if Hollywood was doing that. But in some sort of kind of dark way, I feel like people are resigned to the idea that Hollywood's just going to make Marvel movies. So the end of time now. That's what happens in Los Angeles. If you want to make a movie in Nashville or Atlanta or Bulgaria, then you can make something interesting. But the industry is kind of dead as far as being unique and making fascinating films.
Okay. So I'll just name like a filmmaker and just give me quick thoughts about. Does that sound fun?
Yeah. Maybe this will be where I get into that. Like, I'm not a film buff on any of your levels, so I'm sure I might be like. A pass.
No. I'll keep them.
I like it. I think it's a fun idea. I love it.
Todd Solondz.
What a phony! What a poser! His first film was
Welcome to the Dollhouse.
Is a great movie, and everything else is after that is shite. And by the way, the glasses that he wears, you know, they're fake. He wears fake glasses.
No.
Yeah, they're not real glasses. It's just plain plastic.
How do you know?
Google it.
doesn't make it real true. That just why you so you didn't think happiness was
I think happiness is such
dark horse.
A,
you, did I you just, see dark I, horse?
No, and oh, yeah. So no. Great. The last one I saw was the word spelled backwards is the same as it is forwards. Whatever palindromes, which is just a horrible mean.
That wasn't one of the
nasty little movie.
All right. Okay, so
happiness is the only one that I've seen.
And what'd you think
of those? I liked it a lot. I have a kind of a. I mean, maybe this is out of left field, but I have like a true crime interest in movies that mm-hmm. I have to deal with, like pedophiles and those dark things. I appreciate so.
Right,
and I thought that was a raw, like
no, I know. I remember from mentions in the podcast, and the best serial killers come up. And don't you have a running thing about?
Well, we talk about Crash a lot.
I know you talk about Crash, but specifically David Cronenberg's Crash.
Yes, David Cronenberg's Crash. Yes,
the other Canadian.
We talk about the real one. Just like we only talk about the
Paul
real
Haggis.
Steve McQueen.
I said
you
Paul
know?
Feig. I apologize Paul to Paul Haggis. Feig. I meant Paul Haggis. Yeah.
Paul Haggis. By the way, both Canadians.
Good
David,
point.
David.
Good point, but the real Crash.
No, okay. Yes, no, the other Crash. Well, it got
the
him.
Non-Academy
yeah, but,
Award-winning
but, so I was
going to
say,
Crash.
Haggis got the Oscar, so you're wrong.
No, but I must be right because of everything that we've just said.
Yes. So Paul Haggis, he actually did my podcast and was a really
don't get
generous.
Me wrong. I love Paul Haggis.
You do?
Yeah, I do. Totally, totally
is
do.
Is there a Paul Haggis film you liked?
Going Clear. I thought he was great in Going Clear.
He was great in that, and I sent him an email right afterwards, and he responded immediately. I thought it was very brave because he broke out from there, and I didn't know that he had done that, and I had him on my podcast just before it became public. Very frustrating because I would have talked to him about it at the time. I did a Q&A with him at Tribeca Film Festival for this last thing he did, which was he was basically apologizing for the movie, and it just was at Toronto.
What's the film?
The one he did with – it took place in a hotel with Liam Neeson. He was in this movie – and it's just awful. He plays a writer. It was just awful movie. Nobody saw it. It was just horrible. Anyway.
All right, I'm going to put
Paul Haggis. Okay, now we know. Okay, Paul Haggis.
Roman Polanski.
Okay, I'm glad you brought up Roman Polanski. This is your turn. Well, that's what we should do, round robin. Okay, I think Roman Polanski is one of the great. I'm another apologist. So I would say things like, just to set the record straight, Woody Allen and Mia Farrow were not married, nor did they ever live together. Just that part of it, you should at least cite the facts. Because people say, you slept with the daughter.
Okay, but right,
now when
come
it comes
to Roman.
Okay, Roman Polanski. Okay, it was a couple of years, but he had a nervous breakdown for all intents and purposes. His wife was butchered by the Manson family when she was, I think, 8 months pregnant. He was away on a trip. The poor son of a bitch had to fly. Wait, like, you know, back then, you got the news. Everything took forever. Then he had to get home, and he had to fly home to, you know, after he already heard that his wife was killed and his baby. He was so in love with Sharon Tate. Tell me, if you were in his shoes, you wouldn't go through a self-destructive, drug-infused, like, time. I mean, and you have all the money okay. You could ever want.
Good
so
enough.
I'm going
to
say,
we don't have to go for
I'm,
a,
I'm no. just saying, does it make it right? No. Does it explain his behavior?
No.
He still raped an underage girl.
Okay,
now,
and her mother brought the 14-year-old girl knowing...
Oh, well, that's true, but that's not a crime.
And also, I don't want to...
Okay.
We've gone far enough. Anyway, the point is...
As a filmmaker. One of the greatest.
And let's talk about your favorite Roman Polanski movie.
Okay. Well, I'm so glad you guys recently talked about it.
We drunkenly discussed
The Tenant, which is one of my favorite movies as well. In fact, but I hadn't seen it in years, and I didn't even recognize the movie through your discussion because I have to rewatch this. I'm forgetting everything. And I think I actually have a copy here. But yeah, my friend Lucio brought that to my attention. I was so grateful. It changed. It was one of those films that really made me into it. It brought up my level of being from a passive movie lover to a more active movie lover. I mean, I was brought up on Rosemary's Baby and Chinatown. And so, but I saw a lot of these films when I was a kid or a young teenager, like Tess, went to see in the movie theaters when it came out, loved it. With a few exceptions, even on this, some of the weaker films, I feel like he's still relevant.
All right, I just want to say, I'm so happy that you said Tess, because for my money, Tess is the most phenomenal literary adaptation.
Really?
I watched it recently. Yeah. I saw it about 6 months ago. It's on Filmstruck right now.
Oh, it is.
Yeah, and also this is a commonality between Polanski and Tarantino. They shoot with one camera. They know exactly what the shot is that they want. They get that shot, and they move on. Mm-hmm. And that, to me, is filmmaking.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Polanski, my opinion, pedophile, rapist, shitty dude, should be arrested, amazing filmmaker. I don't know. That's kind of how I feel with these things is just
don't hold back.
Just like, you know, like divorce the two things and the idea that you need to judge the two. And you know what? Judge the two, and if it taints the movie for you, it tainted the movie for you.
But it goes back to my defensiveness about my saying outright, I love Polanski, and then having to say,
I think.
But he's a rape, but like dealing with that response that, you know, well, he raped that girl. And I'm like,
these are all worthy. I think they're worthy things to just say.
I disagree with it, and he should pay the penalty for it. Yeah. The right penalty. I mean, he should be tried justly and fairly and based on the crime.
But the problem is that he wasn't. They sent him to prison. They put him under psychiatric testing. The judge had said, you know, that if you pass the psychiatric testing, you're done. And then the judge changed his mind.
Right.
This is the reality. These are the facts. And it wasn't. It was the King De Laurentiis who gave him the call in Los Angeles and said, "This judge is going to screw you.
Oh.
You're never going to see the light of day." And De Laurentiis drove him to the airport, and he's never been in the country since. Amazing. And there's a couple documentaries.
Marina Zinovich,
Roman Polanski, Wanted and Desired, is the most recent one. I highly recommend anyone who drooling and horny,
I think was the other one.
Anyone who thinks they have an idea about what happened with that case, watch those documentaries. Yeah.
And read Roman by Polanski too.
Yeah, Polanski on Polanski.
Roman by Polanski, or whatever it is.
Yeah, I have it at home. It's a great documentary. Great autobiography.
Memoir. Yeah.
Read that too.
Yeah. Roman by Polanski.
Can I throw out a filmmaker? I haven't seen all of his films. I've seen a fair number of them. Kieslowski.
Oh, great one. There's still a few I haven't seen. I'm so excited because I forget. There's a couple of early ones I haven't seen. I had a girlfriend back in the early 90s, who turned me on to him, and we went to see the trilogy of Colors together. Then, of course, I had to go watch Decalogue. But the first one, I think I saw it because I remember seeing it before she turned me on to Double Life of Veronique. Mm. But I didn't know the director.
It's brilliant.
But I didn't know Kieślowski per se. But then I dated this girl, and the music,
Zebra Prisoners soundtrack for Double Life of Veronique, priceless.
And he also does in the song that appears throughout all of them. He does a score for that.
Okay.
I was disappointed
with the Decalogue. I waited for a long time. I got through the first six, and I still have four more to go through.
Okay. I have a box set of his short films, which I haven't watched even.
But the Red, White, and Blue trilogy is, and that's the last thing he did. I think he retired after that.
Did he die?
I thought he retired before he died.
No, I don't know. Maybe he did. You may be right.
So I believe he made the film Paradise, though, much later. I might be a little wrong on this.
I don't think
okay,
that's true.
I'll hold off as a person that I nominated that I might be way off base with.
That's Berlinger and...
But the Red, White, and Blue trilogy, it's up there with the Apu trilogy. As far as trilogies go, I think there's those...
Those are...
Yeah.
Yeah. And those are thematically tied, but not. Whereas Apu is this actually covering the life of one person. But Red, White, and Blue.
There's a very loose tie between favorite trilogies. But like, I'll just give the pitch for them is that they are three movies about people living in the French speaking world, some of them in France, some of them in Belgium, I believe. And there's very loose ways in which these.
They're connected.
Just Red, White, and Blue. I'm just talking about those three films. And there's very loose ways in which they tie in. But they represent the colors of the French flag, and they're very different types of films. And one's Égalité, Fraternité, Liberté. And one is a comedy, one is a tragedy, and one is somewhere like in between. And those films like mean a lot to me, and I try to watch them like once a year.
Oh wow, I haven't seen them again. You know, so many. I saw them as they came out in the movie theater, and I haven't seen them since. And
Filmstruck.
I haven't talked about Filmstruck. In fact, two episodes back, I had on one of the two programmers, Michael Strigo, was on the show. So listen
also
to that.
Credit.
Yeah. Yeah, he writes for Film Comment.
He's been around forever.
Yeah.
Love him. Great Film Credit. Been around for a long time.
Yeah. He's
one of my early favorites.
Oh, okay.
Yep.
I haven't read him, but there's a lot of missing space. So it's my turn. Okay, Lars von Trier.
So I had the first podcast that I ever was close to being on was going to be called the Von Trier Trials, where we were going to ask a single question every week. Is Lars von Trier full of shit? And my friend Eric and I were going to watch one Lars von Trier movie starting at the beginning and asking that question. And
That's a rhetorical question. I hate rhetorical question in leads, like news leads, where you see like that kind of thing. Is von Trier full of shit? No. If you're going to write that article, the article that you write is Lars von Trier is full of shit, and you prove why in your piece. Otherwise, it's not good journalism. So I think if you had gone with that as your tact, I think you would have – I'm glad that you didn't, because we probably wouldn't have this podcast. But
what do you think of him, though?
He's a master. He is the most rigorous filmmaker that we have.
Huh. Okay.
In the world.
I mean, he's so rigorous. I was so disturbed and blown away by Melancholia. Like, I remember leaving that day, and I was supposed to go into another, it was the New York Film Festival. I was supposed to step into another press screening afterwards, and I had to skip it because I was just so, like, just off kilter and disturbed and emotional. To see Melancholia on a big screen was a pretty big deal. I didn't have that reaction to...
Couldn't agree more.
Yeah. It's really upsetting film.
I think Nymphomaniac is the only Lars von Trier.
You may be right, though. Part one and part two.
I thought what was very interesting about it is that it had basically NC-17 X-level sex depicted, which was not... really erotic in
any
way.
It was just misleading in that way, but
I thought that was interesting is that like I feel like the guy could film some good porn if he wanted to, but I thought it was presented in maybe something like a National Geographic like lens, and as somebody who makes films of some low quality, I'm interested in being able to use your framing to make it either sexy or not.
Okay, I have to say, the way that the story, the narrative comes together and it reaches its inevitable climax speaks to the relationship between men and women, the way that women and men seduce each other, and the obligation, the responsibility of integrity that men and women need to express in their communication. And I think that film explodes so many myths about feminism and just about culture. I think it completely democratizes sexual agreement, sexual expression, and the way that film draws to its inevitable conclusion tells you everything that you need to know about the union between a man and a woman, because all of these ideas, predispositions, expectations that people have that they bring to the table when they come together for a sexual congress is addressed in that film. And so to me, the way that movie surprises you and shocks you and yet completely tells you everything that you already knew is something that I've never experienced any other filmmaker do.
I like what you're saying. And one thing that's interesting about what you're saying is I think you're riding a line of, like, you could say very much more succinctly the point that you're trying to make if you were not worried about, like, spoilers. You know, like, if you can kind of just talk about exactly what happens.
I thought it was pretty good.
But I'm saying...
I said what I meant.
I think you did. But if you can talk about exactly what happens in the last five seconds. I'll leave it out because I want to bring up this question. What do you guys think of the covetousness of what happens in plot and the idea of, like, spoilers? Cole, as someone who writes reviews and you as someone who talks about movies, is this really that big a deal to not reveal what happens in movies and to have this taboo about not revealing spoilers?
It's a matter of just respecting the audience, like giving the audience...
Well, if you've ever read a Roger Ebert review, and I've read many, many, many,
and many Pauline Kael reviews as well.
I think Roger Ebert was dead. But he's still writing
reviews. So I find that really offensive. If you go on IMDb, you know, you get like RogerEbert.com. And also, you know, I don't know if you know this, but the last few years of his life, you know, he was farming out his film reviews. I find it very offensive. But you know, if you read any of those reviews, it's you know, they tell the story, they tell what happens in you know, that was my introduction. That's the way that I started out writing film criticism. I guess I've racked up, I don't know, 2,600 or so reviews in the past 20 years, and now I've kind of backed off of it, where I don't go into the story as much, but it's the nature of the beast. If you're going to talk about, if you're going to get into a discussion, if you're going to get, you know, granted it's a one-sided discussion because you're speaking to your audience, but you have to address things in the narrative, and you're going to expose things in the narrative.
Right. So if you choose to read reviews, you know that you're probably going to more likely be exposed to spoilers. That's just part of the bargain. In my show, I generally go out of my way, and even like certain documentaries don't have the classic narrative structural kind of spoiler like a story would, but there's like some piece of information that is going to happen that's going to be surprising or will inform the ending of the doc, whatever it is, and I do respect that by leaving it out. I'll be careful how I word stuff, because I know that regardless of whether or not it's a big deal to me or not, there are people listening who care about that, and the filmmakers often care about keeping certain surprises, you know, secret. So I respect it. And it's easy to know, to tell what they are, and they always appreciate when I do it. So it's sort of like, you know, I don't care. I can always talk about something else.
What I find interesting about the show that
reviewing a film,
the show that Cole and I host, is, I mean, for one thing, we're often reviewing films that are 25 plus years old. And but one
there's
thing,
no spoilers.
But what we
intuitive
thing of not wanting to reveal the twist until about approximately the equal way through our episode, the movie.
Well, that's
a good idea too,
just to create tension.
I think we're subtly creating tension, but like we have this idea that someone's going to be listening and be like, "Oh, you know what? I've got to go watch this movie." And we're like, so if you haven't seen it, we're gonna wait until
You could just say, you know, this show contains spoilers. I don't think you need anything more than that little disclaimer, so people know.
What I've always thought,
even if you didn't, like, they're gonna learn that pretty quick from listening to the show. They've been around, like you say, these aren't new movies. These are part of the pantheon of classic cinema in most cases. I mean, you know, if you have 21 Up, that's probably not gonna be, but. You know, and guess what? They turn, you know, 22 or 23. You know, I mean, the point is there's no real... I mean, but there is, like, you could say, oh, they, you know, got divorced, things like that. I mean, every film has its own version of what a spoiler is my point, so...
All right, so I have a question for Adam.
Blah, blah.
So you know, now you're well on your way. You're in your groove. So, you know, where are you satisfied? Is this... what you want? Do you have what you want and you're just going for it?
I'm in a new phase, and the phase is really being more producerly, meaning like I just saw Nick Flynn last night in this author, you know, like at this event, and we were chatting, you know, I had his wife on the podcast some time ago, Lily Taylor, but I was like, would you do, he goes, you were on my friend's podcast, I said to him, which is true, he was on, somebody's been on my podcast twice, an actor named Paul Lazar, and he has his own podcast, which I kind of helped him start. And Nick Flynn was on his, and I said, you were on, you know, so it was a way of breaking in the conversation. He goes, do you want me to come on yours? I said, yes. And he read poetry at there. So what I was thinking is let him read poetry. Not just that, but like, it would be cool to have Nick Flynn reading like a poem during nobody's ever read a poem on my show, but I've had people perform like songs. But now what I'm thinking is also just ways of making it. Like I did one, it hasn't posted yet, but there's a new documentary I saw at Doc NYC called Borderline. And it is about this documentary on this woman who has borderline personality disorder. And so I had on the filmmaker. And I thought, let me invite Michele Negroponte, who is another filmmaker, onto the show, who's done a couple of films on mentally ill people or drug or addicted people. And in his last film, Michel's last film, it's a man, Michel. He was on a woman with borderline as well. And I had them both on. I had on Michel and the subject of his documentary. This time I thought, let Michel sit in because he would just bring a dimension into it. It turns out the filmmaker who made the documentary Borderline also had borderline or has it. She had worked over years on herself to the point where she's very much more healthy a person. In fact, made a documentary, but it's a longer story. So it's this multidimensional segment. And what I'm trying to do is use my bona fides to do things that are a little bit more ambitious in that way, but still ending up with having intimate conversations and stuff like that. But the bulk of it is still going to be these one-on-ones and, you know, yes, that's in a groove, but I'm ambitious. Like I want to produce, you know, like I did this Scored to Death segment a couple of months ago, which I really liked, which was I invited on this guy. He wrote a book called Scored to Death, which were interviews with musicians who have many different composers who have scored horror films over the years. Like he interviewed like 30 of these guys. So I had on the author who and putting me on the spot.
That's okay. Keep going.
Yeah. But I had Larry Fessenden, the producer and actor and director. He wrote the foreword for the book, so he came on, and also one of the composers came on, and so it was great. It was like this, and then I had put together all these clips, and we had a contest, sort of like name the movie that this is the horror film score and the, you know, who directed or whatever. So it was a lot of fun. You know, I'm trying to produce more also and think outside of, and having a studio, which I use a lot now, is helpful in that regard.
Yeah, if you're anything like me, and I imagine, Cole, you're like this too, is you find something that you're interested in and you figure out how to like technically execute on it. But then as soon as you hit this level of competency, it's the next thing.
Sure.
It's the next, how do you add complexity to this?
Right.
All right, I got the mics.
Right.
I've got the rapport with guests. How do I take this to another level and get people going deeper into themselves, into discussing the projects that they're in and collaborating?
I found, because I do, you guys, even though you have on occasional guests, I know, but it's a different thing. You guys can do yours Cole, you have the same setup right here. Like you're sitting at your dining room table or your kitchen table doing your show, which is really nice, and it gives it a very authentic and casual nature to it. What I'm doing, though, is I found the studio, which I used to use a lot at Bbox, and then that ended. And I lost my studio, and then I invited people to Rooftop, but it's a big schlep, and now it wouldn't be because, you know, they're nearby. I probably could go back and ask. But I have a studio, again, but there was this big period where I didn't have it, nor I didn't really have the apartment set up for it, you know. And I was running around all the time, and I found having my own home base where people come to is also really important because it sets up a tone. It sets up, this is my show and you're my guests, you know. Yeah, so I can do more things, and, you know, I much more prefer. But, you know, when you're having on Paul Haggis, you know, or you're going to have on whomever, you have to go where they are.
I'm really looking forward to Joe Carnahan walking into my apartment.
Oh, right. You said that was a possible.
Yeah, no, it's going to happen. And, you know. It's
great.
What I like about your stuff is that, you know, you have this, you know, you're on this pulse of independent cinema, and that's your thing. That's your beat. And you have this rapport. And I think that's just like the coolest New York thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I enjoy it. I didn't, you know, I never thought about it in those terms. Like I just sort of do the thing I know. Yeah. But I slid into it, right, because I started necessarily like doing these Brooklyn small filmmakers that I happen to know because I fell into this little pocket of people, you know, who did a lot of my early shows, you know, and I try. And what's nice is I bring them back occasionally, and I love bringing people back and then there's like I'm creating like Michel Negroponte. I mentioned he's been on three times. And like Larry Fessenden has been on three times. Like I love having a list like group of New York filmmaker people that have really got that are so fucking thoughtful, like Michelle Negroponte and Larry. You know, they both have so much to really, they care so much, and they have so much experience, and they have so much to say, and they want to share it because they care. And it's awesome, you know, and they're not there to fucking market, and they're not there, you know, I mean, they're there because this is what they've really dedicated their lives to, and it's great. So, you know, that is what I love, tapping into that. And I would love just to, like I say, just do one show after another with people like that every week, and fuck whoever, you know, if you're not listening. But I feel like, you know, they will come and listen. I don't know, maybe I don't have as big an audience as I could because I dilute the show by having on people that, you know, I kind of, I don't know.
Like
I would like, not at all. But I would like
I just
know,
want to say
you
that
you guys
that,
are
that,
invited
that,
back.
But the most significant lesson that I've ever learned in my life, I learned from Ron Parmentier, even though he pronounced it Parmeter. And he was my jazz guitar teacher. And sadly, he passed away at the age of 50 because he smoked since he was 9.
I lost my guitar teacher the same way. Joe Monk.
Really?
Chain smoker.
Oh, my God.
Jazz guitar player. Are chain you? Smoker.
Oh, man.
In his 50s, yeah. Pretty sure. Maybe.
Damn. And he and this guy who's from Detroit, just a badass, wiry dude. And down on Thompson Street, I was down on Thompson Street every week. And, you know, and Ron's thing was always, less is more. And it took me so long to get that. You know, to get that less is more, and it's true in jazz, and it's true in everything.
I agree. Yeah, I would just, you know, and now I just try to, but I try to inject more of my humor. You know, I try to, I really do, because I have a lot of humor, and I
well,
was
that
found.
Kind of dog, you have to.
Yeah, kind of. But I think I was suppressing it. I don't know intentionally or not. And then I just started. You know, I in my day to day, I'm constantly using humor to break tension, to socialize, to become more comfortable with people. It's my own way of breaking the ice, etc. But I'm not I've got this sense of humor in particular, and I'm not really bringing it as much as I could because so many people that I have on the show are strangers, and I don't know. But I've like, you know, you got to do it.
Well, podcast,
there's listeners and they want to know that it's the same guy interviewing all these people. why is this guy this behaving this way in one way and then another with a friend of his? Like, he should be the same way with everybody.
Podcasting is an interesting thing that we're inventing what this medium is. And there are pioneers in it. And I mean, Marin's going to go down in the history book as kind of like defining it in a certain way. But I think, you know, it's shifting in all directions.
Sure.
And, you know, it seems like you can talk for 17 minutes at the front end of an episode and people will still listen to your content apparently. And then,
I don't even do that anymore with Mark Maron. Sorry. And I don't expect a lot. That's why I put in time. I'm sorry to interrupt you, Mike, but I put in, I don't even know that, but I know that Joe Rogan,
Gary
does.
Vaynerchuk is who you're talking about. No,
Joe Rogan, his podcast.
He was at the 92nd Street Y. Oh. We'll address that on our next
Rogan,
podcast.
Rogan, and these guys are in a whole other. Obviously, they were famous before they did a podcast, so it's a different ballgame. But Rogan, you know, he top loads the show with ads, so like you can skip ahead about almost 5 to 10 minutes. And with Marin, I listened for about 2 years, maybe longer, and to every moment, you know, from beginning to end. And I just got tired of like his. Whether how authentic it is, it doesn't matter to me. I just don't want to hear. I just want to hear the interview, and he gets the best.
And,
so.
I have to say, like the whole ad thing, I find really offensive. Well, here's a story.
I don't know.
A couple years ago, I don't know if you've looked at my website because the last time we did Bruno Dumont, I hadn't renovated my.
Well, no,
my
I remember
website.
That you when you did though. Yeah.
And one of the decisions, like hardcore decisions that I made pretty early on when I renovated the site was no ads. And, you know, what Mike and I do with the beer is part of the experience that we're having.
I understand. You're not doing
and
you're not
so,
taking money from beer companies. But what if
if we were, you're not going to get any more than what we already do.
Right.
Like, you know.
I understand. You're not
like,
hawking.
That's it. We're not I'm not trying to fit somebody else's format.
You're not going. Forget what I said about all those other beers.
Yeah, fuck that.
Two Roads is really
that's horseshit.
Better,
yeah. And also, there's a lot of great breweries, and Two Roads is one of them. I mean, I love Two Roads, but you know, the thing is, like, you get what you get from us, and we're talking about what we talk about. That's how we roll. And that's and that ties this whole thing together. You know, I like how, you know, when we were setting out the parameters of this podcast, because, you know, we had you on our show and then we wanted to come on yours. And we said, you know, what do you want to talk about? And you were, you know, and you said something about, you know, like how you guys, you know, formulate your podcast. And I think that's a great, you know, that's a great thing that we've done in this discussion, is just kind of break down our approaches and stuff, and also, you know, realize that, hey, you make your own rules. That's really how it is. You make your own rules.
Well, that's the beauty part of podcasting.
And it's the beauty.
It's liberating.
That's what people want. I mean, I think that's what everyone wants, is you want to be yourself.
I got this guy who emailed me just the other day, Neil Cohen. Nice Christian fellow. No, Neil Cohen, he wrote this film years ago in the 80s, and he directed it, called Chief Zazu. Do you know what this movie is coming out, finally? It's co-starred Alan Garfield, you may remember from The Conversation, among other films.
Remember? Who's he in The Conversation?
He was the guy, you know, the sleazy...
The chubby other...
This is years later, and he lost a lot of weight, though. I forget the guy's name, but he did a bunch of Henry Jaglom movies, and he's been...
Henry Jaglom! I knew that name was going to come up when you were... We were talking earlier about... You were saying, like, you know, like, sometimes it doesn't go right. I interviewed Henry Jaglom.
Yeah.
Like, one of my first interviews like, 1998. And I swear to you... The cassette, because that was in the old days, the cassette got lost, and I had to apologize to the publicist, like, I can't transcribe the interview, because
well, Jaglom is one of those guys who many times I'm sure is just not a good interview, but he is so I should say this, his movies are awful many times, but he is so fascinating and his story is so fascinating. Anyway,
Peter Bogdanovich, part 5.
You say it the same way?
Yeah, no, because he had his whole relationship with the Orson Welles.
Yes, right. Both of them, yeah. Or Orson's guy, Orson's kids, yeah.
Sons of Orson. I love it.
Yeah. But I think Bogdanovich is far more.
But then Bogdanovich lost his mojo.
Yes. Oh yeah.
We're talking about Jeff Bridges and the Last Picture Show
one of the best films ever made.
If you were going to stick me on an island, and this is the only movie you can watch over and over again, I could choose that
takes
one.
Takes all her clothes off. You couldn't remember her name.
Thank you. I forgot Sybil Shepherd's name one time.
Yes, and
that's proof we don't edit.
And you can remember her breastises.
Yeah. She was, and you know what? She surprised me because she looked like a real woman, not a movie star in that movie. In Naked, she had her body was not, it was like not
normal.
It was just much more normal. And she has she has a face that could, I mean, and you couldn't
Catherine
remember Deneuve Heartbreak Kid.
Nothing.
Couldn't remember the name of Heartbreak
Catherine,
Kid.
Catherine Deneuve has one beer. Nothing on Sybil Shepherd.
Oh, wait a minute.
Okay, well, she has a few things, but still.
Repulsion era, Catherine Deneuve?
I interviewed Catherine Deneuve in Cannes, and let me tell you,
that's
if,
not easy.
I could have died.
Do you know who I interviewed?
I could have just left right there. I could have left the planet.
I agree, but you know who I interviewed? And I love the Grand Dames, too. I am so...
All right, spill.
Liv Ullmann. Oh, that's... You asked me before my favorite. That is one of my favorite because we were flirting. And we were talking about her grandchildren, her granddaughter, and my son getting together. All this, listen to Liv Ullmann on Film Wax Radio. And Claire
Wait
Denis.
A minute, let's get that clear.
I love Jean
Let's
Moreau,
get that clear. So. Wait a minute, hold on, hold the phone now. I emphasize this: if you want to like get into some serious film wax, Google this.
Yeah,
Google Liv Ullmann on Film Wax. Google that, because that's what I'm doing tomorrow.
Anyway, it was a lot of fun.
Googling me, do you, Cole? I'm so uncomfortable right now.
We're winding down.
It involves.
We're winding down because we're watching Cole Smithy.
Descend into talking about his one-handed Googling.
You can't humiliate me. You can't shame me.
You can't.
If you're going to try, let me tell you, you just can't do it.
Yeah, so listen to that. Catherine Deneuve Jean Moreau, Brigitte Bardot. We can keep going. Jean Moreau as a young woman also. I love the smoking because she was just, she had the, little bags. You know, when you first start getting the bags, the French girls, because they all get it from smoking for 40, 50 years. And then they look, by the time they're 45, 50, it really shows. But before that, just as they're starting to look, there's something really set. Right. A little weathered and still young.
Oh, yeah.
There's something like Jean Moreau early films.
That's when William Friedkin caught her. That's exactly when he caught her. He had her for like 8 years. They were married
right.
And I interviewed William Friedkin on a yacht in Cannes.
Oh, yeah. I heard that
for
story.
For Bug. I'd tell it again.
Yeah.
Like,
he's on my show, too.
I could listen to that guy all day.
I know. All day.
All day.
Yeah.
All day.
He just said, he just came out with a quote, though, saying that.
I know. Bullshit.
He was Giselle. Giselle.
No, he was right about Joe Carnahan. Joe Carnahan will mop the floor with that.
I haven't seen La La Land.
So. Giselle kid.
I think he's very talented.
He is. He's got a lot to learn.
As a filmmaker. He's so young. And he, I mean,
Joe Carnahan. Joe Carnahan's
very
hardcore.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yes. What's his new film?
Who, Carnahan?
Yeah.
He's working on some.
Okay. I can't remember his last
name. He made Narc. Have you ever seen Narc? I put Narc up against Whiplash and like just walk out the door because it's all over, you know. But anyway, William Friedkin. Yeah.
Yeah, I know. One of the greats. Yeah. Talk about it. Much and consistently, even though, you know, of course he reached a peak, but he's still making relevant films with Bug and with.
And he's just such a great raconteur. I mean, to talk to that guy is just amazing.
He signed my book and then I lost it. I have another copy. I have to send. I'm going to
send
it
to his
office.
Interviews were John Irving and William Friedkin. Well, John Irving, you could have an 8 or 9 hour conversation with John Irving, and it would feel like five minutes passed. That was a round table, but let me tell you, that was the door in the floor.
Yeah.
But
did he have something to do with it? As far as like he was on, he wrote the screenplay. He was just involved in that. He went Hollywood with that one.
I talked to him for a long time.
Because, you know, he was definitely one of those authors when I was a kid. Like, when I say kid.
The World of Corneille Degarde.
Yeah. I mean, even a couple of the other books, and they were like 4 or 5 in a row.
Hotel New Hampshire.
Yeah, that wasn't so great. But, there were like 3 or 4 in a row that were really, like, Owen Meany and all these. There were a couple. The name of the podcast is La Grande Bouffe, and it is co-hosted by Cole Smithy and Mike Lacey. It, like I say before, it drops on Fridays. What's your next show? I know one came out today. What was today's?
Today's was Cutter's Way.
Cutter's Way. No wonder where you were bringing it up. I apologize.
Yeah, with our guest host.
Oh,
Matt,
so that's today.
Matt Blankman.
Today, December the 9th. So, and what's coming up on the 15th?
And the 15th is going to be Claude Chabrol's La Cérémonie.
Oh, I saw that.
With Isabelle Huppert.
Okay.
Who's terrific
very young.
And ageless.
Yeah,
as
she is.
Ever.
She's
63. She does not get old. Though she does not age a day.
And probably makes more films than any actress alive.
And hits every note.
Never
and
misses.
Every
yeah.
beat.
Yeah.
She is a machine.
You don't
of
think
artistry.
She's a bit of an ice queen? Doesn't matter. She's
of course
talented.
She is. And so is Catherine Deneuve.
Yeah. Jean Moreau, was she an ice queen? No.
Not so much.
No, not so much.
No.
Not when she was making Italian films.
No.
You can't be an ice queen. They don't have ice queens in Italy. They only have them in France.
And I think you kind of have to.
You can use that quote.
Yeah, I think you have to be a blonde or a redhead to really be an ice queen.
Oh. And that may be true.
We're going to wrap up the year with our eponymous podcast on La Grande Bouffe. I finally watched it and found out why our show is called La Grande Bouffe. And I got to say, I'm a little disturbed. I'm a little freaked out. And also, makes a lot of sense. Because that movie has some twists and turns in it.
There's a movie called La Grande Bouffe.
Yeah,
The Big Feast.
The Big Feast.
Okay,
Mari
Ferrari,
1973. Okay, I've not seen it. Look forward to seeing it.
You can find a couple other of my podcasts at buster.fm. I've got also Cat Talk. It's a podcast co-hosted with some alt comedians here in New York City. And then just launched a new one called The Room Where It Happens, which is a political podcast.
Okay, so you're not in a relationship.
I also have a job.
I know.
Yeah. The Room Where It Happens is cool. We interviewed I got new tennis shoes. It's called The Room Where It Happens, which is based on a song from the show Hamilton. We interviewed one of the Republican electors from Texas that's going to vote for Donald Trump, which may be the past now. But we got some interesting perspective on what's going on politically and talking to people about how to have power these days. How do you have power, you know?
Yeah.
It's a tough question.
And so
Gwyneth Paltrow, goop it up. That's how you have power. Goop it up.
How do people find you and your...
How
do I reach Cole Smithy
you can reach me personally if you really want to email me through my website. You'll see how you can contact me. ColeSmithy.com. Couldn't be easier. That's SMITHEY.com. And also on Twitter at Cole Smithy.
Okay. And then the website, right. And, of course, everybody knows me, so I don't have to get into that. Thank you, guys.
Thank you, Adam. I can't say how honored we are to have been on your podcast.
Twice.
And how honored we were to have you as our first guest on our podcast.
I am, and trust me, I really was very, very tickled to come back anytime.
Yeah, thank you, Adam. This has been a blast. I really appreciate the chance to talk with you more.